NBC News holds a unique place in broadcast journalism. It's the only old-school network news division that clings to the concept of journalistic impartiality, yet also has a sister cable channel in MSNBC that has found ratings success with a primetime ideological tilt, in MSNBC's case, to the political left. The distinctions can get a bit tricky, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
Savannah Guthrie is seen as a rising star within NBC News. You can see her on NBC Daily as a White House correspondent.
There's not a lot of good news in this poll for the White House. Gushing oil, persistent unemployment, the real problem.
Or as an anchor of a weekday morning political news and interview show on MSNBC.
The end of an era and potentially a problem for the president's Wall Street reform plans.
Usually, she's paired with her colleague Chuck Todd, though on the day I dropped by MSNBC's Washington Bureau, she was hosting the show solo. As a reporter or host, Guthrie says her mission is clear.
I can tell you what my goal always is to try to think of the one question they'd rather not be asked, just to see what they would say.
Guthrie is a graduate of Georgetown Law who passed the Arizona bar in 2002 with the highest marks of anyone that summer. But she had also worked in local TV news, and after a stint as a lawyer, she joined Court TV covering the trials of Zacharias Moussaoui, Louis Libby, and others. She jumped to NBC, reported on the 2008 presidential campaign, and now her bosses say her promise is unlimited.
I'm constantly blown away by her range.
That's NBC News President Steve Kappas.
She's had a very quick rise within the organization, has absolutely earned respect every step of the way from nightly news to the Today Show to MSNBC. And those are different clients looking for different things, but she's been able to do it.
In fact, MSNBC can be a very different client. Her show appears at 9 a.m. Eastern, but the primetime hosts who pay most of the bills, such as Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow, all can be found somewhere on the political left. It puts Guthrie's work under extra scrutiny.
I know what everybody says, but to me, we just do straight news, and no one has ever asked me to do anything other than that.
And Guthrie and Kappas both say it'll stay that way. Thanks to Charlie Gibson and Katie Couric, network TV stars no longer have to choose solely between softer news or harder-edged fare. But now, to advance to the big leagues on cable, many anchors find themselves adopting a sharper and often ideological tone, which leads former CNN and ABC News correspondent Charles Bierbauer to offer some advice. Bierbauer is now dean of the Communications School at the University of South Carolina.
This is what I teach students here. Keep your biases to yourself. I don't want to know what they are when I go to the news. If I want opinions, I go to the editorial page or I turn on one of the political food fights. But I know what I'm getting.
Not necessarily so, says former CBS News Senior Vice President Marcy McGinnis. McGinnis is now an associate dean of journalism at Stony Brook University in Long Island. She says the top-rated opinion hosts, the Bill O'Reillys and the Keith Olbermans, blur the lines.
I think the format looks like news. You've got anchors. You've got people talking to reporters in the field. And I think that viewers might be taken in by the fact that it looks so much like a news show that they might not be able to differentiate necessarily the opinion.
Or differentiate the news. Over at the Fox News Channel, where the most dynamic opinion hosts are all somewhere on the political right, anchor Megyn Kelly is another rising star. But her tone can be quite sharp. Recently, she tore into Fox's own Democratic analyst, Kirsten Powers, over an incident involving members of the New Black Panthers at a voting booth on Election Day 2008.
He is.
But Megyn, I didn't say it wasn't voter intimidation.
You're putting words in my mouth.
I didn't
say
it wasn't voter intimidation.
Don't make me cut your mic.
It sounded more like Kelly's tryout to be Bill O'Reilly's understudy than just another day behind the anchor desk. NBC News President Steve Kappas says he's very careful not to push Savannah Guthrie in an ideological direction. He says it would be a waste of her talent. But Kappas is also not apologetic about MSNBC's mix of political news and talk with ideological primetime programming. As he acknowledges, it took a long time for his cable channel to hit on a successful formula. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The giant oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has dealt a harsh blow to communities up and down the coast, threatening wildlife, fisheries, and tourism in parts of all five Gulf states. But the disaster is particularly alarming for people who live on the fragile edge of Louisiana. For decades, they've battled to save a vanishing land. In part one of an ongoing series, The Disappearing Coast, NPR's Debbie Elliott follows one family of Cajun shrimpers as they adapt to this latest threat.
Hey, you gonna pick up those life jackets?
Yeah.
Okay.
David Chauvin is seeing his wife, Kim, out the kitchen door. She's rushing off to attend a BP safety meeting. Instead of selling shrimp from the dock behind their house, the former high school sweethearts are now running a fleet of 25 shrimp boats that have been converted to skimmers.
One year you go from pulling trawls to oil booms. You can even imagine. If I'd had the weirdest dream I'd ever had and the scariest dream I've ever had, I don't think I could even imagine something like this. Yeah. I mean, I went from carrying, delivering shrimp around to now I deliver personnel and supplies for BP around.
The Chauvins live in their namesake, Chauvin, Louisiana, a small stretch of dry land just off Lake Boudreau in Terrebonne Parish. They own the Mariah Jade Shrimp Company and have three large shrimping vessels built by David and his father, Anthony.
All three of my children, all three of my boats are named after. Yeah. Mariah, we've been bringing her aboard the Mariah Jade since she was a baby. She, my wife and my daughter and my two sons, they would come with me all summer long.
The sons, who used to splash around as toddlers in the boat's saltwater tanks, now captain two of the shrimp trawlers. And 14-year-old Mariah Jade helps her mom manage the loading dock out back where other local fishermen bring their harvest. Shrimping has been a family affair for the Chauvins for five generations. David's great-grandfather, Cap Chauvin, was doing it long before oil was discovered off the Louisiana coast. Today, oil rigs are as common as shrimp trawlers. David Chauvin says he never realized how devastating a spill could be. It came into focus those first days after the Deepwater Horizon exploded when he was approached by a representative from BP.
This thing was actually still burning offshore. And he explained to me the situation, how they had never had this happen in this amount of water. And trying to fix this problem is probably just as bad as trying to fix it on the moon. So my heart sank in my chest and I'm thinking, okay, how bad is this going
to
be?
The man asks him to assemble a team of shrimpers to help with the cleanup.
And at that time, I mean, we weren't affected at all. The boats were still fishing. Our season had just started to crank up. So I said, tell you what, I said, let me pray on it. Let me sleep on it, and I'll get back with you first thing in the morning. And that night, I didn't sleep at all.
For 21-year-old David Chauvin Jr., the decision was clear.
Well, I mean, it was either go shrimping or go save a coastline.
A coastline that was already in peril. Louisiana loses the equivalent of a football field of land every 15 minutes, nearly 25 square miles a year. David Chauvin Sr. says in his 20 years of fishing the Gulf, he's seen the land vanish.
As that those barrier islands disappeared, now you get wave action that used to wash up on the beaches, actually travels all the way into the marsh areas now. And the salt water, of course, killed all the oak trees. Oak trees need fresh water. There are places that we fish and drag the nets now. You can hang the nets and tear the nets. And those are actually oak trees where there was land at one time.
You can see why it's happening in the marsh due south of Chauvin.
So here we are, right, we're leaving from Cocodrie, and we'll just give you a quick tour around the marshes.
The Disappearing Coast is a field of study for Alex Kolker, an assistant professor at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. He navigates a small boat through the deep green grass that stretches for miles around.
The story is this area, it's sinking. And of course, you know, some of this wetland loss is part of the natural delta cycle, right? You should have areas of natural growth and decay. The problem is we've accelerated the decay and cut off the growth.
Cut off the growth with levees and navigation channels that choke off the sediment that would naturally flow from the Mississippi River to feed the marsh, and accelerated the decay by carving up wetlands for industrial purposes, like oil and gas exploration. You can see the result where broken up patches of marsh dot what is now open water.
The scale of the wetland loss here is tremendous. We've lost something close to 20% of the wetlands of the Mississippi Delta over the last century. So that's an area about 2,000 square miles.
Coastal activists say if there's anything good to come from the BP oil spill, it's that restoring Louisiana's coast now appears to be on the national agenda. They believe they finally have an advocate in the White House, now 50 years after scientists first realized how fast Louisiana's coast was disappearing. Still, there are competing ideas about what coastal restoration would look like. For instance, putting back what has been lost or simply stopping the decline. And now there are fears the oil washing ashore will only accelerate the problem. For the Chauvins, the problem is more immediate.
This oil is it's a tragic thing, I ain't gonna lie.
David Chauvin, Jr.
This is the only way of life that me, my brother, my daddy, my papa, his daddy, we all knew. This is something that, matter of fact, this is all I knew. I didn't go to school. I quit in seventh grade. This is all I knew. Engines, trawls, everything you could put on a boat. I think the only time I didn't go shrimping was from 18. I had worked 2 years in the oil field, and it ain't for me. I like trawling. That's just me.
Now he's trawling for oil, trying his best to save what he knows. The well blew on April 20th, and by April 30th, the Chauvins were running Task Force 1 and what would develop into BP's Vessels of Opportunity program, using local fleets to fight the oil. David Chauvin Sr. says it's been good to have that work, but he's wondering what will become of the shrimp and his family's future.
That would be the scariest part out of all of this, that shrimping as we know it would be over with. It could cost me my heritage.
David Chauvin's fear today echoes the sentiment of his great-grandfather Cap more than a half century ago, when oilmen first set foot in the bayou. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Okay, one of the great pleasures of being a 21st century movie fan is that so many movies are now available online, and every day more are available. One of the great frustrations is incompatibility. Some formats work on certain devices. Others can be streamed from the internet but not downloaded. Today, a consortium of entertainment and consumer electronic companies announces plans to change that. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on a new technology called Ultraviolet.
The idea is that online movies should be as easy to get and enjoy as a regular old DVD.
You can buy a DVD from any store and play it on any DVD player.
That's Mitch Singer. He's president of a group that includes movie studios like Paramount, TV manufacturers like Toshiba, and retailers like Best Buy, and about 60 other major businesses that make movies, sell them, or build things that play them. If you want to watch the Swedish movie The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you can, instantly, on Netflix. But it's a stream. You don't own the movie. You can't burn it or swap it from your TV to your iPod. With Ultraviolet, you can buy a digital movie, watch it across different devices, store it in an online library you can share with your friends, and copy it to DVD.
Once you buy content, you own it.
Singer says you'll still buy movies from regular online retailers. Ultraviolet is just the format, like Beta versus VHS or Blu-ray versus HD DVD. Exact rules and prices have yet to be announced, and it'll just be movies and TV shows for now. Music may come later. And a few big names are holding out. Disney wants to develop its own system, but Mitch Singer says the company is welcome to license Ultraviolet if it ever changes its mind. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
California has banned gay marriage, but commentator Sandeep Roy recently attended an unofficial ceremony there. It offered a view on how such unions are viewed now among Indian immigrants.
The other day, I watched two friends, both Indian, get married in a beautiful garden in Santa Cruz. One is Christian, the other Hindu. So they had two ceremonies. There was a three-tiered wedding cake and a sacred fire. But the really amazing part of the ceremony was that one of their fathers had flown in from India to bless them. It was amazing because my friends are both men. And watching them touch the father's feet, I realized that the fight over gay marriage is ending. Coming out in India is really about marriage. In fact, the standard coming out line is, "Mom, Dad, I don't think I'm going to get married." For my immigrant friends, being gay in California is not much of an issue. Being unmarried in their 30s and 40s is the conversation stopper at Indian potlucks. One friend said that when an unmarried Chinese friend told his parents that at least he wasn't gay, they retorted, "We'd rather you were gay with kids." When I left India for America, my aunts worried about who I might end up marrying. "I hope it's another Bengali," one told me. Over the years, that relaxed to, "I hope she's a Hindu." Then it became, "At least another Indian?" Until finally we reached, "I hope you'll get married to someone before we all die." The obsession with marriage leads to acts of desperation. I've seen ads for marriages of convenience. 29-year-old professional Indian gay, 5'9", good job, looking for Indian lesbian facing similar family pressures. So at my friend's wedding in Santa Cruz, I got a lump in my throat. Not when they said their vows or when the minister pronounced them spouses for life. I teared up when the father blessed them both. And I remembered that old coming out line, "Mom, Dad, I'm not going to get married." The next generation of immigrant gays and lesbians might have to come up with some other line. In fact, I can imagine this ad in the local Indian weekly. Hindu, very well-established Los Angeles family, invites professional match for daughter. 25, 5'3", fair complexion, senior executive in Fortune 500 company. Prospective lesbians encouraged to reply in confidence with complete bio data and returnable photo. Must be professional, under 30, caste no bar. It might just be time for the gay arranged marriage.
Commentator Sandeep Roy is host of New America Now on member station KALW in San Francisco. You can comment on his essay on NPR.org's opinion page.
13,000 cartographers, geographers, social scientists, and city planners descended on San Diego last week for a conference on digital mapping. They create and use sophisticated mapping technology for all manner of things these days to respond to emergencies, improve mass transit services, chart rates of disease in communities. The children of the conference attendees were also in on the learning experience, as Lisa Napoli reports.
Ballroom D looks like any other windowless ballroom in any other convention hotel, except for the fact that it's tricked out with giant cardboard cutouts of cartoon forests and animals and flat-panel computer screens. Welcome to high-tech geography camp.
We're making a map to show where there's suitable pastures
for cattle and sheep
to go and graze and live when there's an emergency.
11-year-old Rosemary Norheim of Seattle is working with her partner through the first assignment, drawing a digital map to show which parts of the San Juan National Forest in Colorado are safe for grazing animals. This software is a version of what her father, an environmental research scientist, uses in his work. Making a digital map, the class leaders say, is like making a sandwich, a layering of pictures and data. Instructor Colin Child says while children grow up today with GPS in the car, they need to learn how those maps get made.
It's our job to try and build the connection between what they use these days together with what they should know about map reading and about the kind of doing analysis and stuff and asking questions.
This is fifth grader Kovid Talam's second year at camp. His favorite aspect of this map-making process is personalizing it.
For me, for most of all, what I like is the legend. You get to change everything on the map. Like, just one color can change the whole map.
After a snack break, Kovid and the other kids are clicking through the prompts on their screens for their next assignment, to reconstruct Mount St. Helens before its eruption. Using 3D mapping technology and a worksheet, they build out the layers of the volcano. Soon, all the computer screens are lighting up bright orange and yellow and green, and everyone's virtually navigating the digital mountain landscape with their mouse.
Ah, so that would be the forest, and that would be the Grand River? Okay, now we can see the actual elevations here. So that would be the lowest is what they're saying. This little strip of yellow over here is the second lowest.
Waiting in the wings for his sons is Jason Duke. He's a geographer with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Tennessee. Here at the conference, he's presented maps he's made using this kind of technology to chart the fate of birds affected by the spill in the Gulf. He said the disaster is the perfect reason for his kids to learn what he does and why maps are so important.
Everything now is so visual. Everything has a map, from MapQuest to Google Maps to all the maps that we're producing with this software for the oil spill. And of course, you can show your children a lot, but they always believe you more, and it comes from someone else.
And maybe they respect you more, too. Here's Duke's 9-year-old son, Carter.
Now I know why he's so tired when he gets home.
For NPR News, I'm Lisa Napoli.
This is NPR.
The drive to decriminalize marijuana gained real traction in recent years. Oakland City Council votes today on a plan to establish 4 pot factory farms. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states and okay with the Justice Department, but hard drugs like cocaine, well, that remains a political non-starter. In a new book, author and documentarian Tim Filing argues the worst thing about cocaine is that it's illegal. If you've had direct experience with cocaine as a user, law enforcement officer, a doctor, we'd like to hear from you. Is it time to legalize? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Tom Filing describes the cocaine industry from the Colombian coca fields to the U.S.-Mexico border into America's inner cities. His book is Cocaine Nation, How the White Trade Took Over the World. And he joins us today from our studios in London. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And legalize cocaine, really?
That's the last third of the book. It comes at the end of quite a rigorous analysis of the attempts to prohibit cocaine trafficking and production since 1970 and President Nixon declared war on drugs. And the end conclusion I came to was, yes, we'd be much better off by legalizing drugs like cocaine.
You also write in the book that you've had friends who have suffered from it, and yet you still come to that conclusion?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to know where to start with this story. But certainly, in picking that up, my point is, for those people who do have terrible problems with cocaine dependency, cocaine addiction, I don't think that the marginalisation and the criminalisation of their behaviour does them any favours. Now, I know that the heritage that I'm picking up on, in talking about drugs, is a lot of people will regard that as somehow being a message of promiscuity or saying yes to drugs when we should be saying to no. And I think I've tried to be as sober as possible in this book and saying this is not a moral judgment one way or another on drug consumption. I'm talking about from a law enforcement and public health point of view, how do we manage drug abuse if it's the case that there is no chance of living in a drug-free world? In other words, we can't get rid of cocaine. That's my first premise. So how do we best deal with it?
You argue, in fact, that it has been treated not so much as a crime in the United States, but as a sin.
Well, I think it's been very politicized. The whole culture war, as a non-American, I think the American experience of cocaine has been unlike any other country. And America was the first country since the Second World War to have mass abuse of cocaine. And that followed on from a time when America generally was very laissez-faire with cocaine at the end of the 1970s. So I think there was a real swing. There was a time when people clearly underestimated the danger of the stuff.
Right. Yeah, that laissez-faire period was at a time when people and official people thought, this is not addictive. It's not really a problem.
Yeah, and I think people have been trying to make up for lost ground ever since.
Well, part of that was, in any case, the analogy you draw in the beginning of the book, really there were a lot of them, but the biggest one is to prohibition, the experience of trying to ban alcohol back in the late teens and the early 20s.
Well, yes, that was, I think, the last time that the murder rate that we saw in the mid-80s in the States, when the war on drugs was at its height and the crack cocaine economy was at its height, the last time America saw that kind of murder rate was during the alcohol prohibition period. So there certainly are parallels in terms of the violence and corruption that went with banning alcohol. We saw the same thing with cocaine. And there's a lot of interesting parallels, too, about how consumption changed when alcohol consumption was made legal again.
At least in most places. And indeed, that it took a long while, but eventually it rebounded back to the levels before prohibition. But a lot of people would say, well, you know, we have a lot of problems with alcohol, too.
Well, yes, but I don't think no one would suggest that we make alcohol or tobacco illegal. There are lots of things that need to be done to reduce the harm done, mainly effective treatment, education. But criminalizing it would be counterproductive. Now, I've argued in the book that perhaps we should use the same way of thinking with illegal drugs like cocaine. And be ready to admit the huge problems caused by criminalizing it.
There's a story you tell about Kurt Schmoke, the former mayor of Baltimore, who was eventually came to the conclusion that legalizing drugs or decriminalizing them would be the best approach. And he was brought out to a discussion where he realized that he was heavily outnumbered and turned to his audience and said, if you found your daughter had a major problem with cocaine, who would you call? Would you call a doctor? Or would you call the police?
Yes. I mean, it was very interesting talking to Kurt Schmoke about his experience as mayor of Baltimore. And I think one of the things that, you know, that he pointed up was the fact that there is an exoticism. There's something strange and unusual about cocaine. So people are inclined to think of it in different terms to alcohol. Whereas when you think about people's attitude to alcohol, we acknowledge on the one hand that, yes, it blights and destroys a lot of people's lives. The actual number of people who become dependent on alcohol, percentage-wise, is quite similar to the number of people who become dependent on cocaine. But we at least are able to acknowledge that usually if that person is alcohol-dependent, they have underlying psychological issues that need to be addressed. We don't say, let's ban this crazy substance.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest is Tom Feiling, author of Cocaine Nation, How the White Trade Took Over the World, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Joe. Joe's on the line with us from St. Louis.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm a criminal defense attorney here in St. Louis, and as you might imagine, I deal with drug cases quite a bit. And I have to say I am in total agreement with your guest based on what I've heard thus far. It's been my experience that, particularly in America, drugs, most drug cases give you a felony on your record. And then the problem is you try and go back to your community and find work, and you have to put down on any job application whether you're a convicted felon. And so it becomes this cycle where people who have a drug problem kind of end up stuck in that way of life or in the system because they're unable to get the help that they need because they're stigmatized with the felony on their record. And, of course, these people don't stop having children in the meantime, and life goes on. And so now we have children being raised in families that are not probably the most stable, and those children harmed by it. So in all, the best way to handle drugs from a legal perspective is to legalize them and treat them like cigarettes. These people are addicts. They belong in a hospital. They don't belong in a prison. And that's not to mention the expense and time and the clogging of the judicial system with drug cases. I would say 80% of my clients drug cases.
I seem to be arguing against your own financial interests here, Joe. But
I am. But you know, it's for the better good, isn't it? I mean, I'd much rather live in a society where we didn't have this problem and the little extra money.
All right, Joe. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Tom Feiling, I think you put it in the book. People's addictions can be treated; felony convictions cannot.
Well, yes, and I mean, I couldn't have really have put it better myself, what Joe just said. I think talking to a lot of people when I was in the States, there are more and more people working in the judiciary and in law enforcement who are getting tired of the sheer how counterproductive and ineffective and expensive all of this is. And this, I suppose, moves us towards decriminalization of drug use. But coming from a Colombian perspective, because that was my initial interest, that leaves all of the criminal production and trafficking in place. So you'd still have a war on drugs on those people. But the actual users at the other end, instead of sending them to jail and so on, we start diverting them into medical facilities, which I certainly agree with. But I think there is a bigger picture to acknowledge, which if you don't legalize it, if the production and distribution remains in the hands of criminals, you still have the terrible violence and corruption that we're seeing all the time in Mexico, in Brazil, in Jamaica, in Colombia, in all the regions from where it's produced to where it's consumed.
Let's go next to Chris. Chris with us from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I kind of agree with what they say. Decriminalization is the way to go, especially with marijuana, because of the fact that people say it's a gateway drug. Well, it's a gateway drug because you're having to go to a drug dealer's house to buy it. And that drug dealer probably doesn't just sell pot. He sells cocaine, heroin, ecstasy, prescription pills, whatever else. So you're around those other things. If you go to a coffee shop like you do in Amsterdam and they don't have those other drugs, then you can't buy those other drugs and you may never meet those people and go in their house. As far as the cocaine goes, the guy who wrote the book and the attorney are exactly right. They need to decriminalize it, regulate it, tax the hell out of it, make money off it, use the money for rehab, use the money for treatment. They've already shown brain scans that the area of the brain that is affecting when people use cocaine is the same area of the brain that's activated when sex offenders, have their thing with a little kid or whoever.
Yeah.
And so it's biological and physiological as much as it is a choice of something to do. But if you can regulate the amount that goes in it, just like in cigarettes, they regulate the amount of THC that's in each one, so the next cigarette's not twice as strong as the one before.
Chris,
prohibition of alcohol a bit more, and I realize that more people getting hurt and not making enough money.
All right, Chris, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Just have a little time with you left, Tom, finally, but if the argument is to legalize cocaine, surely heroin, meth, everything would fall into the same logic, correct?
Yes, everything would fall into the same logic, and I can understand everyone, the people's eyebrows will be shooting up over the top of their heads when I say this, but I think, when you look at other dangerous, potentially dangerous activities, it is precisely because they're dangerous that we regulate them, we bring them in. To send it out to criminalize these activities worsens the situation. It's precisely the danger involved, the potential danger of drugs like cocaine and heroin, which means that you'd be much better off having a legal, regulated source, which, as your last contributor said, was taxed, and money went into effective treatment and education about those potential dangers.
Tom Feiling, thanks very much. Be interesting to see how the referendum comes out in California. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks very much.
Tom Feiling, documentary filmmaker and author. His new book is Cocaine Nation, How the White Trade Took Over the World. He joined us from our studios in London. You can learn more about how cocaine users have become more mainstream over the years in an excerpt from Cocaine Nation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.